So it's on page 726 of the Red Church Bibles. That's Isaiah 41, verse 1. But before I read, I'm going to pray to ask for God's help. Our Father, you promised that whenever you send out your word, it will not return empty, but will always accomplish the purpose for which you send it. Please, as we hear your word read and applied, would you accomplish all of your purposes in us? In Jesus' name, amen. So that's page 726 of the Red Church Bibles, Isaiah 41. Be silent before me, you islands. Let the nations renew their strength. Let them come forward and speak. Let us meet together in the place of judgment. Who has stirred up the one from the east, calling him in righteousness to his service? He hands nations over to him and subdues kings before him. He turns them to dust with his sword, to wind-blown chaff with his bow. He pursues them and moves on unscathed by a path his feet have not travelled before. Who has done this and carried it through, calling forth the generations from the beginning? I, the Lord, with the first of them and with the last, I am he. The islands have seen it and fear. The ends of the earth tremble. They approach and come forward. They help each other and say to their companions, be strong. The metal worker encourages the goldsmith, and the one who smooths with the hammer spurs on the one who strikes the anvil. One says of the welding, it's good. The other nails down the idol so that it will not topple. But you, Israel, my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, you descendants of Abraham, my friend, I took you from the ends of the earth, from its farthest corners I called you. I said, you are my servant. I have chosen you and have not rejected you. So do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you and help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. All who rage against you will surely be ashamed and disgraced. Those who oppose you will be as nothing and perish. Though you search for your enemies, you will not find them. Those who wage war against you will be nothing at all. For I am the Lord your God, who takes hold of your right hand and says to you, do not fear, I will help you. Do not be afraid, you worm Jacob. Little Israel, do not fear, for I myself will help you, declares the Lord, your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. See, I will make you into a threshing sledge, new and sharp with many teeth. You will thresh the mountains and crush them and reduce the hills to chaff. You will winnow them and the wind will pick them up and a gale will blow them away. But you will rejoice in the Lord and glory in the Holy One of Israel. The poor and the needy search for water, but there is none. Their tongues are parched with thirst, but I, the Lord, will answer them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. I will make rivers flow on barren heights and springs within the valley. I will turn the deserts into pools of water and the parched grounds into spring. I will put in the desert the cedar and the acacia, the myrtle and the olive. I will set the junipers in the wasteland, the fir and the cypress together, so that people may see and know, may consider and understand that the hand of the Lord has done this, that the Holy One of Israel has created it.
Thanks so much. It'd be great help if you keep Isaiah chapter 41 open. Let me add my welcome to Alistair's and to Becca's. My name's Robbie. It's great to meet you. I work here particularly with the undergraduate students. So if you're a new undergraduate student, you've just arrived in Cambridge, Anglia Ruskin or Cambridge Uni, I'd love to say hi afterwards. It'd be great to meet you. I read this really interesting article this week about why people are panic buying petrol. It was The Independent. They'd asked a few like psychologists about kind of some of the thoughts and fears and worries and things behind people's panic buying. And they listed four things. I thought they were pretty interesting. One of them was copycat behavior. You see other people queuing and you think, oh goodness, they're all queuing. They know something that I don't. I better get in that queue and get my petrol. Second thing was like a bit of a dopamine hit. Once you get to the end of the queue and you finally fill up, it's like, oh, great, I've got it. And for that little instant, it doesn't last long, but for that little instant, you feel really good about yourself. The third thing was that it helps to give people a sense of control At least that's what they were saying. One psychologist said this. I don't know what's going on here. You put it like this, maybe. You don't know what's going on. Everything's going a little bit crazy, but if I go and get my petrol, well, at least I'm in control. At least I'm in control of my car, my life, my travel. But the underlying thing, the thing that they kind of most talked about, was a sense of fear and anxiety. According to one of the psychologists, he said, "I believe that panic buying by some and not others is largely down to how well people are able to manage their anxiety." Quite an interesting little reflection, isn't it? I wonder what it is that makes you feel out of control and afraid or anxious. It might be everyday things like, have I got enough fuel to get to see my parents or whoever I need to see in the next few weeks? It might be things that we've experienced over the last 18 months, things to do with COVID or whatever. It could be much bigger things than that. Fear about the future, or fear of failure, or fear of illness, or loneliness, or death. It could be something out there. Some of that stuff about Wayne Cousins and Sarah Everard has been pretty fearful, hasn't it? I read today that 81 women have been murdered by men in the UK since Sarah Everard's death. Our world is a messed up world, isn't it? Maybe it's something out there. Maybe it's something in here. Our precarious, messed up lives. That fear of failure or of being found out or of not being good enough. Is there anywhere to turn with our fear, our sense of being out of control? Where is God in this messed up world and in my messed up life? There's a question that this passage, I think, helps us to answer. You'll know if you've been coming to 5pm, we'll be going through a bit of a series in Isaiah, chapters 40 to 48. Isaiah is a book in two halves. The first half, chapters 1 to 39, is this kind of consistent warning of judgment. There's elements of hope too, but the main thrust of that first half is, look, God can be trusted, he's good, but his people turn from him again and again and again. They look to the other nations for help, they look to other gods to help, and that in turn leads to a pretty corrupt Israel, a corrupt nation. God's response to their running away from him is to come good on his warning. He sends them into exile. So with Isaiah open, just flick back to Isaiah chapter 5, and you'll see it in verse 13 to 14. It's pretty early on, like in the book, and the whole of the first half is kind of warning about this. Isaiah chapter 5, verse 13. "Therefore my people will go into exile for lack of understanding. Those of high rank will die of hunger. The common people will be parched with thirst. Therefore death expands its jaws, opening wide its mouth. Into it will descend the nobles and masses, there will their rulers and revelers." You see the sense that God is punishing his people. He's warning his people about judgment because of their turning away from him. But Isaiah chapter 40, the tone completely shifts. It begins, "Comfort, comfort my people." It's as if Isaiah is kind of writing forward. Here's a message to deliver once you get there, once you get to exile. It's going to be the lowest point in your history. It's going to be awful. But this is what I want you to say to the people. It's a section of the book that anticipates lots of questions and objections, like the kind of stuff that we were just thinking about. Where is God in this messed up world? Where is he in our lives? Has he left us behind? We saw some of them last week. God has ignored us in our trouble, the Israelites said. And you can imagine some of the others. They look around this powerful empire, and the Babylonian gods look way more powerful than Yahweh, the God of Israel. Maybe God has just left us. Maybe he's not that powerful after all. Does he even care about us? This whole exile thing, it looks like he's neglecting his people. Now, our situation is a little bit different from ancient Israel. We're not in exile in Babylon. But the questions haven't changed. And perhaps as Christians, we wait for Jesus' return, and trusting the God of the Bible feels a bit lame, a bit difficult. Those questions still probe us, don't they? Where is God in a messed up world, in my messed up life? Is he there? Does he care? The section we're looking at is set up to answer those. And it's kind of like a trial. You'll see it in chapter 41, verse 1. So turn back to 41 if you're still in Isaiah 5. The whole thing kind of reads like a big courtroom scene. Verse 1, "Be silent before me, you islands. Let the nations renew their strength. Let them come forward and speak. Let us meet together at the place of judgment." Silence in court, God says. Let's come to the place of judgment. This time, judgment not in terms of punishment, but in terms of decision. Come and see what I'm like and make up your minds. Will you trust me or not? And there's two big things that Isaiah wants to show his people. He is absolutely good, and God is absolutely sovereign. Don't be afraid, Israel, Isaiah is saying. It's time to make a call. Will you trust in God or not? Let's take them in turn. Here's the first. It's kind of verses 1 to 7 or so of Isaiah chapter 41. God alone is the sovereign ruler of history. He is absolutely in control. He's the sovereign ruler of history. This kind of courtroom trial begins with a couple of rhetorical questions. Verse 2, who has stirred up one from the east, calling him in righteousness to his service? He hands nations over to him, subdues kings before him, turns them to dust with his sword, to wind-blown chaff with his bow. It's describing this kind of powerful warrior-type person from the east. We'll learn a bit later on in the next few chapters that this is actually a Persian emperor called Cyrus the Great. Now, forgive the kind of history lesson, but Cyrus the Great had this massive empire that swept throughout the ancient Near Eastern world. It kind of went from North Africa all the way up to Greece, and then right through Turkey, the Middle East, Central Asia, all the way to the border of India. A little bit later, he's described, Isaiah chapter 21, verse 25, as one from the north, because his empire is so massive, it literally circles Israel and Babylon. And this warrior is really powerful. Turns them to dust with his sword, to wind-blown chaff with his bow, verse 2. He pursues them and moves on unscathed. It's like he's gliding effortlessly through the nations, unstoppable, crushing armies and kings and nations before him, like just walking on eggshells. Now, King Cyrus is actually pretty world famous. The Greek historian Herodotus said that every nation without exception was brought into subjection by him. He has a huge influence on history and civilization. You can go to the British Museum and like see statues and reliefs of him. You can visit his tomb in modern day Iran. He's one of the big kind of empires and emperors of history. But the question in Isaiah 41 is, who's behind all this? What's behind this Cyrus the Great? Who stands behind his sweeping victories? And the answer, verse 4, is pretty bold, isn't it? Who has done this and carried it through, calling forth the generations from the beginning? I, the Lord, with the first of them and with the last, I am he. It's like God gives you a tour of the British Museum and says, I did that, I did that, I was behind that victory and that one. Remember, we saw it last week, the nations are like a drop in the bucket for God. Cyrus's victories, they're chalked up as the activity of the sovereign Lord of all. And there's a key lesson then for God's people. As they look around the world that seems so out of control, history is more than human. God is absolutely in control of nations and governments. Jacinda Ardern, Boris Johnson, Vladimir Putin, Carrie Lam, COP26, the AUKUS Pact, supply chains, fuel crises. God is behind and in control of it all. Now, it might be that you're visiting church and you're kind of not a Christian. You would maybe call yourself a Christian. You're kind of investigating Christian stuff and you think, this is ridiculous. This is such a massive claim. But actually, it's kind of a uniquely Christian thing to say. Unlike other religions, other ancient religions of the time, the evidence for God's power and activity in the world is not some kind of primordial creation epic or some alien war of the gods where creation just kind of spills out. Because God is not some kind of local deity. The claim there in verse 4 is that he's called forth generations from the beginning. He is the source of all life. He is the first, with the first of them and the last of them, the eternal, self-sufficient, uncreated creator of everything in existence. That is the God of this book, the Bible. Now, I know all this stuff about like God being in control raises some questions about sovereignty. Is God behind evil? What about all those things in the world that are kind of pretty grim and horrible, the suffering?
Now, you can ask about this later. In a few weeks' time, we've got a question time after the 5 p.m. service, and you'd be very welcome to ask that question then. God in the Bible is never described as the author of evil. Humans are always responsible for their actions. But the consistent teaching of this book is that God is absolutely in control and that he works all things together for his purposes. Now, we'll see, this is a huge comfort. And it's a comfort for God's people then and now too. But if you don't know him, it is not a comfort at all. In fact, it's quite a kind of a scary truth. Absolutely sovereign. Just look at the response of the nations and the islands in this kind of courtroom drama. Verse 5. The islands have seen it. Keep reading. Verse 5. The islands have seen it and fear. The end of the earth tremble. They approach and come forward and help each other. They're fearful and anxious. They feel out of control. And so what they do is turn to idols, false gods of metal and wood. Verse 6, they help each other. They say to their companions, be strong. The metal worker encourages the goldsmith. The one who smooths with the hammer spurs on the one who strikes with the anvil. They're all kind of trades and tools used for creating idols. One says to the welding, oh, it's good. But the other nails it down so that it doesn't fall over. It's ridiculous, isn't it? It's the panic buying petrol response. There's the fear and the anxiety. The ends of the earth tremble. The irrational kind of copycat, self-reinforcing behavior. It's good, isn't it? Yeah, it's good, it's good, it's good. You strong? I'm strong, I'm strong, we're fine. The little comfort hit, it's good. But it doesn't last long. That's a nail in something, literally, to keep this idol from standing up. You're supposed to read it and laugh. It's absolutely ridiculous. How could this piece of wood or metal save you from the sovereign Lord of the universe? If you believe that the world is all there is, that, you know, life is just an outcome of time plus chance plus matter, then this is how you respond when things get messy and out of control. You seek to find comfort and strength in gods and purposes of your own making. But the reality is that nothing else can help. I've been helped by the preacher, Ray Ortland. He kind of describes an anti-Isaiah chapter 41, the kind of opposite of what Isaiah is saying here. And he says it's a bit like this. In the anti-Isaiah 41, nobody knows the future. If we could see the future, we'd be scared to death. Reality, he says, is random and pointless and stupidly cruel. All we're left with is to make up our own purpose in life, our own goals to live for, our own gods to worship, and to hope for the best. But the bottom line of this world is, be afraid, be very afraid. Because there is no one looking out for you, no one has your back. Everybody is trying to use you to get one over on you, and all you have in this lonely, messed up world is you. How different is Isaiah chapter 41? Our God is in control. He is able to help. But a key question then becomes, does he want to? Is he willing? Yes, sure, he may be powerful, but is he on my side? After all, it was sin that caused the Israelites to go into exile in the first place. And it might be a similar kind of question to what we're asking too. It feels messy out there, but I know that it's messy in here too. Does he actually want to help me? Point number one, God is absolutely in control. He alone is sovereignly in control of the nations. Point number two, God alone is the loving helper of his people. He's the loving helper of his people. These are some of the best bits, I think, in the whole of Isaiah. Let's follow through. Verse 8. But you, Israel, my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, you descendants of Abraham, my friend, I took you from the ends of the earth. From its farthest corners I called you. I said, you're my servant. I've chosen you and have not rejected you. Now, servant sounds a bit kind of demeaning, but it's actually a very exalted title. And it's the first time it's mentioned here. It's going to come up a lot more in Isaiah chapters 40 through 48 and following as well. The details will be fleshed out as we go along. But you can tell even here that it's an encouraging term because of the way that it's paired with those other two words in verse 8. Jacob, it's another name for Israel, whom I have chosen, you descendants of Abraham, my friend. Not rejected, but loved. Literally, that's the word friend in the original Hebrew. It's like lover. And so the big application is there in verse 10. If this is how God feels about his people, do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you and help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. It's the first of three do not fears in this passage. Don't be afraid because I am on your side. God is for his people. He'll strengthen and help. It's the exact opposite of the idols, remember? They needed to say to each other, be strong, be strong. And then at the end, they needed to bang the nail in and strengthen the idol itself. But God strengthens his people. He upholds you with his righteous right hand. And as we go on, there are kind of three little ways in which God shows how much he's for us. He's the God, firstly, who helps the fearful. The God who helps the fearful. Verse 11, all who rage against you will surely be ashamed and disgraced. Those who oppose you will be as nothing and perish. Though you search for your enemies, you will not find them. Those who wage war against you will be as nothing at all. Because I am the Lord your God who takes hold of your right hand and says to you, do not fear, I will help you. Verse number two, do not fear, verse 13. I'll help you. Because God is on side to help. Now, the enemies described, we don't really kind of get this, I think, because, you know, most of us have not come from places where there's war or anything like that. But I love something like verse 13. It's like a mother or father who takes their child by the right hand. We had right hand earlier, but it was God's right hand, verse 10. He'll uphold us with his righteous right hand. But then he'll take us by our right hand, so you imagine his left hand, holding our right hand. Imagine that. It's like a little kid going into the playground where there's bullies or whatever, accompanied by Daniel Craig in his like full James Bond like outfit or whatever, with all the guns and everything, holding onto his hand. And you think the bullies would just melt away and vanish. That's what happens in verse 12. You'll try and find your enemies again, but you're not going to find them. They're just literally gone. They've vanished in front of this Lord who helps. He's the God who helps the fearful. He's the God who uses the weak. That's verses 14 through 16. Do not be afraid. It's the last do not fear. Do not be afraid, you worm, Jacob, little Israel. Do not fear, for I myself will help you, declares the Lord, your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. Again, worm, it's not like a derogatory term, like, ooh, disgusting or whatever. It's just tiny and pathetic. Just little. But God will make this worm, his people, a masher of mountains. Verse 15, I will make you into a threshing sledge, new and sharp with many teeth. You will thresh the mountains and crush them and reduce the hills to chaff. Israel will be an instrument in the hands of their God. A threshing sledge, apparently, was like a big piece of wood like this that you drag behind a kind of an ox or a horse or something like that, and you'd stick like nails or stones or something sharp in it, and you drag it across wheat and it would kind of somehow thresh it. I don't really understand. But you get the kind of picture, don't you, that God will turn this pathetic little worm, his people, into an instrument in his hands that is not just for threshing wheat, but for threshing mountains. I don't exactly know what that means. It could be a kind of defeat of nations. It could be a preparing of the way for God to come. Remember chapter 40, verse 4, if you were here a couple of weeks ago, all the mountains will be flattened so that the Lord will come. But whatever it means, the headline is that nothing is going to stand in the way of the Lord's promises to people, to his people. He will make them his very tool to tear down any obstacles that thwart his plans. He will use those who are pathetic and weak like little worms. And finally, he's the God who restores the needy. This is verse 17 through 20. It's kind of a picture of what God's restoration and help actually looks like in the lives of his people. The image has shifted from the mountains to a desert. It's one of Isaiah's kind of favorite images. Verse 17, the poor and needy search for water, but there is none. Their tongues are parched with thirst. But I, the Lord, will answer them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. There's two things you need in the desert. Water and shelter. Apparently you can go for 3 days without water, but if you're under the blazing heat of like the Sahara sun, you're not going to last 3 days. But the Lord will not leave his people alone as they make this wilderness journey. Instead, verse 18, he will make rivers flow on barren heights and springs within the valleys and turn the desert into pools of water and the parched ground into springs. He'll provide for their thirst. Verse 19, he'll put in the desert the cedar, the acacia, the myrtle, the olive, the junipers, the fir, the cypress. Seven trees. He'll provide for them shelter. It's like the perfect number in the Hebrew scriptures. It's perfect provision. Exactly what they need. And this picture of a desert, it's not just like a generic kind of nice picture. The wilderness always reminds us of God's redemption in the Old Testament. His rescue from Egypt when they were slaves under Pharaoh to the promised land. There's that journey and that provision through the wilderness. It's the language of redemption. And the promise here is that God will one day come again to rescue his people. He will bring them out of exile. Turns out Cyrus is pretty important for that. And he will rescue his people, redeem them, restore them. The Lord who restores the needy. Why? Verse 20 is the kind of climax. So that the people may see and know and consider and understand that the hand of the Lord has done this, that the Holy One of Israel has created it. It's a hugely comforting message, isn't it? In a world that is full of fear. Comfort, comfort my people, we heard a few weeks ago. And there's plenty more of this comfort in the chapters to come. But what Isaiah 41 uniquely shows us is that God is both able and willing to help his people. If you had just one or the other, it would not be good news. A God who's able to help his people, who's all-powerful but not good, well then how do we know he's for us? A God who wants to help his people, who's all chummy-chummy and nice, but can do nothing about it, well, that's not good news at all. In the face of our messed up world and our messed up and precarious lives, isn't it good news that both are true? And his goodness and power are on display in pretty much every chapter of the New Testament, and supremely in the death of Jesus Christ on the cross. God on the cross shows us his power and sovereignty over evil. You might want to look up later, Acts chapter 2, verse 23. In a little sermon, one of the first Christian leaders, Peter, explains how it was the plan of all the kind of nations and the enemies of God's people to put Jesus on the cross. But they were all doing that because under it all, God was working his sovereign purposes. It is his plan after all along to send Jesus to the cross to die for sin. He shows his power on the cross. And he shows us, and you guys know this, he shows us his love on the cross. Romans chapter 5, verse 8. This is how we know what love is, because God showed us his love. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. He is the one who is both able and willing to help. And that is wonderful news for us, isn't it? As we close, let me say a prayer. Father, you call your people to this courtroom to decide on whether or not they'll trust you, whether they'll turn to you in their fear and their feeling of being out of control. And Father, I ask that you would show us again and remind us again of your sovereignty and your goodness, that you are absolutely in control and absolutely loving. And Father, I pray that, I praise you that this is the kind of God that you're like. Help us, our Father, this week to turn to you in trust, whatever it is that we fear. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.